Hello, everyone. This is Tracy Shoster, and today I'll be reading from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for the week of Sunday, September 8th, 2019. First up, a follow-up from our friends' articles from last week. Let's follow up with Jennifer Aniston. It's a new morning for Jennifer Aniston. 15 years after Friends, she is returning to TV in Apple's The Morning Show as a news anchor dealing with ageism, sexism, and her co-host's misconduct. Jennifer Aniston was trying to have a quiet weekend away. It was just after her 50th birthday, and she'd boarded a plane from Mexico with six of her best girlfriends, most of whom have known her since her early days in Los Angeles, before Brad, before Justin, before Friends, and before the tabloids, when they lived as neighbors on the same street in Laurel Canyon. We called ourselves the Hill People, she said. But a few minutes in, the pilot asked to speak with her. They had a tire missing, and they would have to return to Los Angeles. As the pilot burned off fuel, Aniston spent the next 4 hours cracking jokes and trying to remain calm. She is terrified of flying, while fielding text messages from friends who'd read about the emergency landing, which hadn't actually happened yet. The women landed safely, switched planes, and the next night gathered for a ritual they've been doing for 3 decades, a goddess circle. Seated on cushions, cross-legged on the living room floor, they passed around a beechwood talking stick decorated with feathers and charms, much as they had done for every major event of their lives. They had circled before Aniston's weddings to Brad Pitt and Justin Theroux. They circled when babies were born and when Aniston and Theroux had to put down their dog, Dolly. This time, they set the circle's intention to celebrate how far they've come and to toast Aniston's next chapter. It's so weird. There's so much doom and gloom around that number, Aniston said of 50, noting that the New Yorker in her, and she spent most of her childhood on the Upper West Side, was slightly horrified at the thought of the term goddess circle appearing in a story about her. Should we just call it a circle? She asked. We were sitting in the kitchen of her sunny mid-century Bel Air home on a Tuesday afternoon in late August. She was warm and radiant, which is how glossy magazines often describe her, and also thoughtful, inquisitive, and self-deprecating, which is not. She asked about the meaning of my tattoo, which led to a conversation about my dog, which led her to ask Siri, "Hey Siri, what does a cockapoo look like?" "I'm a weird dog person, it turns out, like a dog lady," she said, running her hair through her dog Clyde's fresh haircut. She is surprisingly unguarded for someone whom the tiniest kernel of news can transform into 1,000 stories. But about that age thing, I'm entering into what I feel is one of the most creatively fulfilling periods of my life, she said. Seriously, she continued, pausing to knock on her wooden coffee table. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I feel like it's just about to really bloom. This is the kind of thing actors say all the time in interviews, but in this case, it feels more than a platitude. Since Friends ended, Aniston has had critical success in smaller independent films, mixed reviews for mainstream movies, a lot of product endorsements, a couple of outright flops. But nothing has clicked quite like Rachel Green, the beloved runaway bride she played on Friends. She's spent 15 years taking parts that had the potential to get her past that iconic role, that haircut, that cloak of Rachel, as she once put it. But they didn't deliver. Perhaps the only way to do that may be to return to the medium that made her famous. So come November 1st, she'll have a homecoming of sorts as the star of Apple's The Morning Show, a big-budget drama set behind the scenes of a news show that looks a whole lot like Today. Aniston plays Alex Levy, a serious morning anchor whose personal life is complicated and professional life is more so, compounded by the sudden firing of her longtime co-host, played by Steve Carell, for sexual misconduct. For Apple, the show represents the shiniest bauble in its launch slate as it attempts to challenge the likes of Netflix with a streaming service of its own, and among the first shows to hang its premise on #MeToo. For Aniston, who is the spine of the show as both a lead and an executive producer, It's the chance to dig into a more sophisticated dramatic role that, as she put it, has everything. Children, guilt, power struggle, being a woman in the industry, going through a divorce, publicly going through a divorce, feeling alienated, and being just a little bit of a screw-up. It's a role that is asking her to draw on more of her personal life than ever before. And it may also be her best chance to finally get the world to see her as an actor, not just a star. The morning show didn't begin as a hashtag MeToo story. 3 years ago, when Aniston told Michael Ellenberg, a former executive at HBO who oversaw Game of Thrones and The Leftovers, that, quote, television is not an option for me, Matt Lauer was still delivering the morning news and Harvey Weinstein was gunning for Oscars. I said to him, I just want to be part of something great. I don't care where it lands, Aniston recalled, because God knows the movies have been great and they've been horrible, so you just don't know. When Ellenberg later phoned Aniston to tell her he'd acquired the rights to Top of the Morning, a nonfiction book by the media reporter Brian Stelter that delves into the drama-filled world of morning television, and had also spoken to Reese Witherspoon, with whom he'd worked on Big Little Lies, the women immediately called each other. We're so psyched, says Witherspoon, who has known Aniston since they played sisters on Friends. She noted that the two had wanted to work together for some time, but that it was rare to have two very fully fleshed out female leads in one project. Aniston signed on to play Alex, a morning host akin to Ann Curry, who must traverse the cutthroat, ego-filled world of TV news as a woman in her 40s, who executives declare is past her prime. She collides with Witherspoon's character, a brash, younger field reporter who may be gunning for her job or could become her best friend. We aren't sure yet. Apple bought the show in a bidding war and ordered up 2 seasons. If the people who brought you the iPad were going to compete with Netflix and Hulu, Aniston and Witherspoon, who also serve as executive producers, seemed like a pretty good bet. I just felt like this was exactly what we were looking for, said Edie Q, a senior vice president of Apple, overseeing the new service, who declined to name the price the company paid for the show, but acknowledged that the draw of luring Aniston back to TV added to the appeal. But then Weinstein happened. Charlie Rose was canceled. Matt Lauer was fired from Today. And we basically just started over, said Witherspoon. We had to. Carrie Aaron, a creator of the A&E series Bates Motel, was brought in to write a new script, replacing the original showrunner. The updated premise? Alex's longtime co-host is fired after news of his behavior on the job and in his dressing room becomes public, throwing the show and his career into chaos. Carell would be cast to play the disgraced anchor, whom Aniston described as a kind of lovable, cocky narcissist who, like so many powerful men before him, just thinks everybody wants to sleep with him. Witherspoon's character would be positioned as a potential replacement to fill his now open anchor chair. The morning show would still tackle gender and ageism, but also tell a more complicated story of what happens when an idol falls. What does it mean for his unknowing co-workers and friends, like Alex, his ability to seek redemption, and, without knowing exactly of what he's accused, whose side should we be on? Now is the point in many of these interviews when the reporter asks the subject if she, too, has a hashtag MeToo story. Aniston says she does not, though she has certainly experienced her share of sexism in 30 years in the business. Agents, she began, ticking off the list. Studios, finding out what this actor made versus what this actor made. It's our second meeting at her vast modernist home, and this time we're joined by Kristen Hahn, Aniston's best friend of 3 decades and producing partner of 2, who is also an executive producer on The Morning Show. The duo reflected on what it was like when they began in Hahn's garage in Ojai, California, 18 years ago. We called them the garage band days, Aniston said, to try to make movies. It was so much harder, began Hahn, to get our phone calls taken, finished Aniston. Now actors are taken more seriously as producers, Hahn continued. But when we started, even though Jen had been on a TV series for 8 years, it was still a little like, oh, isn't that cute? It was there in that garage that Hahn and Aniston, with Pitt, co-founded the production company Plan B, which was then called Block Productions, a name that had come to Aniston during a game of Scrabble, she said. They developed The Time Traveler's Wife, A Mighty Heart, and The Departed, on which Hahn was an executive producer. When Aniston and Pitt's marriage ended, Aniston and Hahn decided they would be the ones to leave the company. It was the symbolic equivalent of, "I'll move out of the house," said Hahn. Plan B went on to develop the Oscar-winning films 12 Years a Slave and Moonlight, while Aniston and Hahn formed their own company, Echo Films, as a side project when Hahn wasn't writing. She wrote the screenplay for the Netflix movie Dumplin', and Aniston wasn't acting. "Our mission statement was, tell strong stories about strong women," Aniston said. "Flawed, complicated, messy, 'cause that wasn't happening." Currently in development, First Ladies, a political comedy for Netflix, in which Aniston will play the first lesbian president opposite Tig Notaro, and The Gory Girls, a project about one of the first all-female country bands. As a producer on The Morning Show, colleagues described Aniston as detail-oriented, Hahn, thorough, Ellenberg, and precise, involved with every set, with every costume, with every piece of casting, said Witherspoon. When I mentioned to Aniston later that many had noted her attention to detail, she joked that was basically nice ways of saying obsessive. To research her role, she went behind the scenes at Good Morning America and spent time with Diane Sawyer, studying everything from clothing choices to her caffeine habits, which involved toggling between Coca-Cola, Red Bull, and coffee. On set, Aniston handpicked her character's books, 100 Years of Bauhaus on her coffee table, Malcolm Gladwell's Blink in her work bag, the sconces in her apartment, French modern, and her clothes, tailored, monochromatic, an occasional pop of color. She hung photos of her real-life friends, the Hill people, in Alex's dressing room and apartment. There were times Aniston and Aaron, the showrunner, and had healthy disagreements, such as whether Alex, upset with her daughter, would actually say a phrase to the effect of, quote, "I practically broke my vagina with that big head of yours," using an expletive before vagina to describe childbirth. "I was like, that would just never come out of my mouth. Alex's mouth," said Aniston, becoming animated. And Carrie kept saying, "Trust me on this," said Hahn. After 2 weeks of back and forth, Aniston finally agreed to try the line. "And they got it on the first take. It just flew out of my mouth," she said. "So ultimately, she thought Alex would say it," I asked. "Yes," she said, "but mind you, I'm playing a person who's a mother. I've never shoved anything through my vagina, you know what I mean? So it's sort of like understanding where it comes from, you know, like tapping into all of the mothers that I know and understanding how something that hysterical and vulnerable and raw is possible." Hahn leaned over to note that Aniston had, in fact, been there in the room at the foot of her bed for the delivery of Han's daughter. "I could have actually done it if the doctor had let me," Aniston said. "I literally came back into consciousness hearing the doctor say, Jen, you're in my light. I can't really see," Hahn said. That's what friends are for. You could say that the story of Alex Levy is also the story of Jennifer Aniston, one of being underestimated and overexposed, known for a thing that may or may not have had anything in common with you, who are trying to reassert control over your narrative. "Jen has lived in the public eye for so long," said Ellenberg. "To play the role of Alex," he says, "she's drawing on real stuff in her life." Alex, who is declared by her male boss to have passed her, quote, sell-by date. Alex, whose smooth smile appears on billboards across the city, but whose life at home is more complicated. Alex, who the world feels they know intimately, personally, but are nowhere near acquainted with. "There's a similarity to my life," Aniston acknowledged. "I relate in ways of feeling like when you don't want to be seen and you don't want to go out of the house and you want to just scream and you don't want to walk on a red carpet. I don't want to stand behind a podium. I don't want to have my photograph taken. I just want to cry, you know?" I asked if she could have played this role at any other point in her life. "No," she said firmly. "I didn't have the experience." There is a saying that's popular these days, translated into memes and posted on Instagram, that the freedom of aging as a woman is the ability to just care less, said with a punchy expletive. Aniston sort of buys that, but she thinks the freedom may come more from working than age. "It's experience backing up ambition," said Hahn. As they're talking and I'm preparing to leave, another member of the Goddess Circle, Andrea Bendenwald, who is Aniston's oldest friend and also plays Alex's makeup artist on the show, walks into the house holding a book that the group is reading. It's called Lifespan, written by a Harvard Medical School scientist, David Sinclair, who makes the case that the key to slowing down the aging process is to access the so-called vitality genes. They are worried that mention of this book will make them appear like they're obsessed with not aging, but perhaps what it signifies more clearly is that they are interested in longevity. The longevity to keep working, to keep taking risks, to redefine themselves. It's taken time for me to get where I am, and I put a lot of work into my craft, Aniston said. I've failed, I've succeeded, I've overcome, I've stayed around, I'm still here. That, in Hollywood anyway, is perhaps the most radical thing a woman can do. From the theater section, is Broadway ready for a slave play? Risky? Oh, for sure. Triggering? Possibly. A must-see? Audiences are about to decide. The first day of rehearsal on Broadway usually goes like this. Circle up, make introductions, offer thanks, express optimism, maybe crack a joke. Clear the room of onlookers, and off you go. But Robert O'Hara has a more pointed agenda in mind when he found himself in a ring of 75 actors and designers and producers one midsummer morning in a studio lined by a wheelbarrow, a four-poster bed, and refreshments labeled dildo cornbread and nutcakes. Mr. O'Hara is the director of Slave Play, Jeremy O'Harris's raunchy, riveting, and risky new work, whose many provocations begin with its double entendre title. Mr. O'Hara, like Mr. Harris and many members of the cast and crew, is black. So with just 4 weeks to go until the preview, he ignored the naughtily named snacks and invoked his forebears. For many years of my life, I've had random white people come to me and ask me about where my last name came from, and I would just look at them in the face and say, very politely, slavery. Mr. O'Hara told the rapt gathering at New 42nd Street Studios, quieting the lingering chit-chat, I just want us all to be mindful that it's because of what our ancestors endured and survived and abolished that we have the audacity to be in this room. Upping the ante, he turned to the show's producers, most of whom are white, and threw down a challenge. Quote, I want you to be mindful of the responsibility that you have, to put the marquee with the name Slave on it in Times Square, he said. And I would ask you, with every decision you make, are you upholding the legacy of that name? Broadway is a perilous place. Even amid an overall boom, most shows fail financially. But Slave Play, which is costing up to $3.9 million to capitalize, is chancy in new ways. Arriving 400 years after American slavery began, the play, often funny and pervasively unsettling, examines that lingering wound through the frustrated sex lives and taboo sexual fantasies of three contemporary interracial couples. Set on the grounds of a Virginia plantation, its racially charged sex talk and simulated dominance and submission are potentially so triggering that a pre-Broadway production supplied post-show lobby counselors. An internet-based backlash, seemingly fueled by people who had not seen the play, was threatening enough to require stepped-up security and online vitriol directed at the Broadway production, prompted the show's social media team to disable Facebook and Instagram comments. The 8-week off-Broadway run at the New York Theater Workshop was hailed by numerous critics. In the New York Times, J.C. Green called it, quote, willfully provocative, gaudily transgressive, and altogether staggering, while Wesley Morris deemed it, quote, the single most daring thing I've seen in theater in a long time. Among those packing into the 199-seat East Village Theater to find out what the fuss was about, Madonna, Whoopi Goldberg, Scarlett Johansson, and Stephen Sondheim. The Broadway production is now in previews and scheduled to run for 17 weeks at the 800-seat John Golden Theater. The producers, a team that includes the actor Jake Gyllenhaal, the music manager Troy Carter, and the documentarian Abigail Disney, a great niece of Walt, need to harness the enthusiasm and, yes, the edginess as they seek to persuade ticket buyers that they will miss out if they don't catch Slave Play. This is going to burn fast and bright and hot, predicted Greg Nobile, the 27-year-old lead producer. If you want to be part of the cultural conversation, you must see it. Many of their participants still can't quite believe this play on Broadway is happening. Absolutely, I'm amazed, said Wakina Kalukanga, the actress playing Kanisha, a black woman from the American South, married to a white man from Britain. They really said yes to this? Solange's Almeida streamed over a laptop in a capacious photo studio in Koreatown. There were hair people and makeup people and a tailor and a sewing machine, a stylist and a publicist and ad reps and talent managers and who knows how many assistants, one of whom spent the morning steaming racks of clothing that might never be worn. It was the day of Miss Kalukanga's portrait shoot and a lot was at stake. Online objections to the off-Broadway run had been set off, at least in part by a photograph in this newspaper showing Kanisha dressed like a slave, twerking for her husband, costumed as an overseer. A hashtag was born, hashtag shut down slave play, as well as an online petition objecting to the play as degrading black women and dishonoring enslaved people. The criticism, as happens these days, got ugly. Some of it alluded to Mr. Harris's sexuality, he describes himself as queer, and some featured homophobia, anti-Semitism, and threats of violence, according to Jeremy Blocker, the managing director at New York Theatre Workshop. The nonprofit called the police, beefed up security, and offered car service home for those feeling unsafe. Cast members, although not surprised that the play was not to everyone's liking, were troubled by the hostility. I hope that people will have an eye toward the complexity of blackness and that blackness is not monolithic, said Ato Blankson Wood, a black actor who portrays one half of a gay couple. Why can't we just make space for all of these experiences? But word of mouth was excellent. The production was sold out and the show now has another run. This time, the creative team is determined to control the visuals. Press photographers are being barred from shooting sex, nudity, or the scene in which Kanisha wears slave garb. We want to be extraordinarily careful about how we use the images of the play, Mr. Nobile said. In the current state of the world, it's very easy for things to be pulled out of context. So there Miss Kalukanga was in that photo studio, perched on a stool, wearing an oversized dress shirt cinched by a vintage corset, and displaying the fleshy interior of a halved cantaloupe. Behind the camera, Duane Ivory, a photographer hired by the production, who said, quote, "My goal is to visually document all the things that make black women powerful and beautiful." The shirt, said the stylist Gabriella Carafa Johnson, speaks to the way that strength in black women is often mischaracterized as masculinity, and the corset represents sexual freedom but also bondage. The melum, a prop in the show, adds mystery. So much of our campaign is about generating curiosity, said Stephen Tartick, the executive creative director at the play's marketing agency, RPM. What we need to do is to want to learn more. Miss Kalukanga got the role after her friend, Tayoa Paris, who played Kanisha downtown and weathered much of the animus, decided not to join the Broadway production. Paul Alexander Nolan has remained in the cast as the character's husband. Ms. Paris's publicist, citing her filming schedule, she is starring in Jordan Peele's Candyman, said she would not be available to speak for this story. But she has supported Miss Kalukanga, who said she decided to audition after being shocked and excited by the script, and after Ms. Paris gave me the green light. Miss Kalukanga was warned about the likely blowback. I told her that they will come for us and they will come hard, and several of them will look like us, Mr. O'Hara said. But she said she believes that her character, twerking and all, is honored by the play. She's on a journey to her own sexuality while dealing with the traumas of her past, and she's very much navigating what it's like to be a dark-skinned black woman in this society, she said. It's really empowering. Her photo has become the heart of the show's, quote, key art, featured on websites and posters as the producers and their marketing team seem to make clear that slave play, despite a title that might suggest a period piece, is character-driven, contemporary, and centered on a strong woman. I'm taking back the narrative of what this play is, Miss Kalukanga said. You think you know, but you have no idea. Mr. Harris, then an aspiring playwright in his late 20s, who was about to start graduate school, was listening to a fellow reveler describe a kink-fueled sexual encounter. Ever the provocateur, Mr. Harris asked whether the man, who was white, would have felt as comfortable making party chatter about his experimentation if the woman he had been having sex with was black. Squirming partygoers tried to change the subject. Mr. Harris decided to turn it into a play. "I wanted to make a play that is difficult for an audience to dismiss," he said. He noted that during his childhood in Martinsville, Virginia, he routinely saw Confederate flags and visited plantations on school trips. "I'm from a place where I saw the ruins of chattel slave trade everywhere around me," he said. "Its presence is part of my present all the time." He wrote the intermissionless three-act work while in his first year at the Yale School of Drama, and from the beginning it was both successful and shocking. He asked for an intimacy director to safeguard the performers during sex scenes. New York Theater Workshop, the birthplace of Rent, asked to stage a production and sent Mr. O'Hara the script. "I remember reading the first act and going, 'This play is crazy. Why are they always sending me the crazy plays?'" recalled Mr. O'Hara, himself the writer of scabrous, boundary-pushing plays about race and sexuality. "And then I read the second act, and I became very excited." Even before the downtown production began, the play attracted interest from commercial producers, albeit theatrical adventurers with limited Broadway experience and a hunger to highlight new voices. Mr. Nobile and his producing partner, Jana Shea, read the script, raised $150,000 to support the off-Broadway run, and with that obtained the commercial rights. The two are an unusual pair. He is a college dropout who runs a seasonal tiki bar in coastal Branford, Connecticut. And she is a resident of the same town and the mother of one of his childhood friends. Their company, Seaview Productions, named after a street in their hometown, has invested in multiple productions. Here, they have top billing. Mr. Harris, who has begun writing for television and film, emerged the show's magnetic ambassador, conversant in Afro-pessimism and Harry Potter, Bruce Nauman, and Tyler Perry. A garrulous whirlwind, he is also unmissable, 6 feet 5 inches tall and often clad in Gucci, Telfar, or Tom Brown. As luck would have it, among those who saw the show downtown was Mr. Gyllenhaal, who had formed a production company with Reva Marker and wanted to join the slave play team. Then came Mr. Carter, who was once Lady Gaga's manager and an executive at Spotify. Mr. Harris's agent reached out several times to gauge his potential interest, and once he finally read the script, he wanted in. "I've always been involved with very unique artists, and I think Jeremy falls into that category," he said. Unlike most of the producers, not only on this show, but on Broadway overall, Mr. Carter is black. But he said that's not all he brings to the table. "Definitely one of my concerns is making sure there's a diverse audience, but I didn't want to just show up as the black producer who answers the black questions," he said. "It's everybody's responsibility to think about diversity and to think about any sensitivities." Sidewalk stenciling seemed like the right idea. It was late July, 6 weeks before the preview, and producers had traipsed over to RPM's Times Square offices to spitball ways to build audience. How about selling tickets via pop-up vending machines, placing posters in bodegas? Could they target digital advertising to readers of stories about race? But Spotify spots aimed at fans of Rihanna, whose music is featured in the play? Mr. Harris was in Europe, but everyone knew his wishes. "My priorities are young people and black people," he had explained. The conversation turned to guerrilla marketing. Mr. Tartick mentioned a company that used pressure washers to stencil logos on dirty surfaces. Everyone was intrigued. The tactic, sometimes called clean graffiti, should be harmless and attention-getting, but Ms. Marker raised a red flag. "Power washing sounds cool," she said, "but the word slave planted all over the city makes me feel concerned." That idea was tabled. Weeks passed, and as a wall of mirrors, topped by an oversized Rihanna lyric, was erected inside the theater, behind the scene, jitters were intensifying. Ticket sales were good, but not great. The sidewalk spray was abandoned, too expensive, too risky. Other unproven ideas were set aside. Broadway is definitely old school, and anybody that's thinking they're going to come innovate should give that another thought, Mr. Carter said. Things are done a certain way. It reminds me of the music industry 10 years ago. Producers decided to bank on building word of mouth before the October 10th opening. They packed Monday's final dress rehearsal with actors, college students, and fans Mr. Harris reached out to via Twitter. "I'm going to go way back into the mezzanine and cry softly to myself," Mr. Harris told the crowd just before the performance began. "Enjoy the show or don't. I don't know. Watch the show and leave the theater and talk about it. That's why I wrote it." For Tuesday's first preview, Mr. Harris invited a slew of models and designers in town for New York Fashion Week, and the producers planned a wee hours after party at the Swanky Edition Hotel, co-hosted by Telfar. They made 10,000 seats available for $39 a piece, are introducing a digital lottery and an in-person rush system, and are exploring what would be Broadway's first buy one, give one ticket scheme, under which purchasers of premium tickets could also subsidize a seat for someone else. They hired a specialty public relations firm, the Chamber Group, to broaden media outreach and cultivate African-American micro-influencers. And Mr. Harris is putting together a, quote, Black Theater Night, September 18th, on which they will try to fill the theater with African-Americans, including, he hopes, every living Black playwright who has ever had a play on Broadway. A small group, and the subject of a website Mr. Harris has been developing. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, and there's about, a couple pages left to go. So sorry I can't finish that article for you today. I certainly hope you enjoyed listening as I read from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for the week of Sunday, September 8th, 2019. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day today.